And now we will go to an interview which I conducted earlier this week with Kieran Stewart Asherton, a traditional owner and sovereign black man from Wandi Wandian country in the UN nation. Kieran is a founding member of the Black People's Union, an organizer, a writer, an oral historian, and generally a staunch and tireless truth teller and advocate for justice. He really is an elder in the making. Kieran hosts the Yilliman program on 3CR, which airs every Wednesday at midday, including today at midday. And Kieran also hosts the Earth Matters program on 3CR, incidentally hosted the Earth Matters that you heard before the show about orcas and their relationship to people in human country. Kieran and I caught up earlier this week to speak about the aftermath of the failed voice referendum to Parliament, which was held in October of 2023. Have a listen. Hello, Kieran. Thank you so much for speaking with us. How are you today?
Yeah, not too bad. Yourself?
You're pretty good, thanks. So, Kieran, thank you for agreeing to speak about the aftermath of the voice referendum, which was held in October of 2023. You were an integral part of the Sovereign No campaign during the run-up to the voice to Parliament referendum. Could you please provide a bit of background as to why you and some others took that position, touching on the origins of the idea and the people involved in its creation?
Yeah, yes, of course. So this is a much longer topic, but I'll try and keep it as brief as I can. Essentially, myself and the BPU campaign know for a few reasons. Firstly, we saw the voice to Parliament as something that wasn't substantial or progressive. It was put forward as a tokenistic and powerless reform that didn't actually hold any kind of power or authority. In fact, it held less power and authority than any existing organisation or individual. So as it was proposed, the federal parliament retained power over who would even be a part of the voice to parliament, and all of these cherry-picked individuals could have done all they could have done was provide representations to parliament on particular acts of federal government that the federal government gave them prior permission to do so. Now, as it currently stands, any individual and any organisation can make representations to Parliament any issue that they like. So in this context, we see it wasn't just a toothless tiger. It was a proposed body of handpicked tokens that held the absolute least amount of power possible within this so-called democratic system. Now, so listeners at this point might be wondering why it was even proposed in the first place, if this is the case, and the answer very much lies in the fine print. So the voice to Parliament was actually all about constitutional recognition at the end of the day. That's why they insisted on a referendum to change the constitution. It was never about an advisory body, and in fact, there have been multiple Aboriginal advisory bodies at different state and federal levels going back decades now. So now, why did they need to include us in their foreign constitution? At the end of the day, it was to legally cede our sovereignty as occupied nations. Now, as far back as the early 90s, we see mining and energy lobbies pressuring the government to act on the issue of our unceded sovereignty, because these lobbies understood that our sovereignty was one of the primary obstacles to their ongoing resource extraction and theft here. Now, we have to remember that this was all taking place around the same time as our push for land rights, for self-determination, and our sovereignty to actually be recognised by the colony. There were massive rallies, protests, and movements right across the continent in the late 80s and the early 90s, all around stuff like land rights and sovereignty. So the lobbies pressured the government to do something about this, and they sat down with their dodgy lawyers and they drafted this idea to cede our sovereignty and land rights through constitutional recognition. Now, as for the players involved, one of the primary architects of the Uluru Statement from the Heart and the Voice to Parliament is none other than Mark Liebler, who is a Zionist lawyer, who is old schoolmates with John Howard, and who chairs lobbies like the Australian Israel Jewish Affairs Committee. This very same committee is one of the firmest supporters of Israeli occupation of Palestine, and they also put a lot of pressure on the colony here to continue to provide support to Israel's colonization of the Middle East. Now, the effectiveness of the voice aside, we know at the end of the day that Zionists, that mining lobbies, and that racist conservative politicians have never had our best interests at heart. Quite the opposite. and it's very much tied up to their interests in abolishing our sovereignty. You know, this whole voice to parliament, this whole constitution, it was all about abolishing our sovereignty at the end of the day, because our sovereignty stands in direct opposition to their interests as colonial occupiers and resource thieves. And yeah, that's why the BPU and myself and many other sovereign, staunch First Nations people across the continent campaign no and push to get back against this.
Kieran, thank you so much for outlining that. I think, it really is telling when the mining corporations recognize the history and the reality, more than the citizens themselves who've had the wool, pulled over their eyes.
Yeah, definitely.
It really is. It's beyond shocking. So thank you so much for outlining that. So there were, of course, a lot of well-meaning people who were involved in the Yes campaign, and also there was a lot of money involved. And those who are at the very forefront of the Yes campaign seemed very passionate about the campaign. But since the defeat of the referendum, it's impossible not to notice that all the resources and all the people seem to have disappeared, and things, of course, unfortunately, continue to get worse for First Nations people in this colony. So many people got involved in and dedicated so much time to the Yes campaign, but somehow this hasn't translated into action following the defeat of the referendum. To your mind, what are the reasons that so many people got behind the campaign, and what are the reasons that this hasn't translated into action post-referendum?
Yeah, so the mass mobilization around the Yes campaign, as we were just talking about, it wasn't truly about justice for First Nations people. Behind the curtains, it was very much about eroding our sovereignty. Now, that's why the government and the mining lobbies and stuff as well poured so much funding into the Yes campaign and promoting that Yes vote. And in fact, you know, a lot of the big mining corporations, the same mining corporations that blow up our sacred sites all the time and displace our communities, they were actually some of the biggest donors to the Yes campaign. But, you know, all of that aside, for the average punter, though, like the average working class person in the street, it was very much about giving settlers a way to feel good about themselves without challenging the colonial structure that underpins this society. That's why it attracted so much support from the, you know, grassroots levels and from the everyday working Joe, and so much donations and media airtime and whatever else, again, from, you know, these average grassroots working class people. It's because it was very much about, you know, just appeasing that settler guilt at the end of the day. It didn't actually require people to give up any land, to share any power. It didn't require anyone to dismantle the violent systems that keep us dispossessed. It just asked them to vote, to symbolically recognize us, all the while reinforcing the authority of the settler colonial state, in the first place as well. So it's no surprise that the momentum disappeared once the vote failed. The campaign was never about material change for us. It was just a feel-good movement built on liberal sentiment, not any sort of revolutionary commitment. For many people, their investment in the campaign was performative or superficial. It was something for them to do to us, not with us or for us. It was easier to rally around a state-sanctioned gesture than to confront the uncomfortable truth that this country is illegitimate at the end of the day and our sovereignty has never been ceded. Since the referendum, the silence has been deafening. You know, there's been no land back. There's been no end to deaths in custody. There's been no dismantling of racist institutions. And why? It's because at the end of the day, most Yes supporters were never prepared to actually struggle alongside us. Their compassion was conditional. It was tied to the comfort of the colonial system. And when that system said no, they folded. The difference between a movement and a campaign is that a movement doesn't just die with a lost vote. But too many people saw the referendum as the final destination, not just a diversion from the real work that needs to happen, which is decolonization.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for outlining that. I think, definitely, as you said, voting legitimized the colonial and bourgeois state as if this is the way to make change, reinforce that. And also, just to have this, people hardly even knew what was contained in the small print of the voice, and we're still so doggedly behind it, despite I think the sovereigns really outlining why the no campaign was important. And actually, people got attacked in the sovereign no camp. It really is very telling. And also, one thing that I noticed was that the voice referendum was completely divorced from any kind of truth telling, even the state sanctioned, I guess, Europe Justice Commission that never received any publicity. Whereas, the voice was just like this thing that stands alone and whitewashes everything. Anyway, thank you so much for outlining that, Kieran. That is, I think, really informative for me and also for our listeners. And so here we are. It's been 17 months since the Voice to Parliament referendum resulted in a no result. What were the impacts of the failure of the Voice referendum on Indigenous communities across the continent? And not just the failure, even the proposal, I suppose, of the Voice referendum. And what is the task at hand in regards to rebuilding and continuing the struggle for Indigenous liberation, to your mind?
It very much did lay bare the deep racism and colonial entitlement that still very much defines this country here. We were offered a tokenistic, powerless footnote in the colony's constitution, and even that was too much for the vast majority of racists to agree to. The vast majority voted no out of racism, not because they wanted to support that small vocal minority of sovereign First Nations people. Now, I obviously see the irony in this. At the end of the day, our sovereignty was very much saved to fight another day by none other than the very same racists who don't want us to receive anything at all. Very ironic position, obviously, but one that I note as being the reality. But I guess, for many of our people, though, it did very much also reignite a lot of trauma. Being told once again that we are on our own land, that even symbolic recognition is too much for this settler society to grant to us. But at the same time, it very much also clarified the task that we have at hand here. We cannot seek liberation through colonial institutions. Our struggle must be independent, it must be unapologetic, and it must be rooted in our own sovereignty, not in colonial recessions or, in any sort of legitimization of the Australian occupation here. Rebuilding means recommitting to those old demands of the 80s and the early 90s that this whole constitutional recognition come about to try and combat, demands such as, land back. Demands such as self-determination, demands such as the recognition of our sovereignty, so that we can, have some land, we can manage our own affairs, and we can be independent from this colony. It means we have to build up our structures of power as well, both outside and against the state. It means uniting our people under decolonization, as opposed to, some banner of recognition or assimilation. The referendum failed, but we won't. We've been fighting for 255 years now. If it takes us another 255 years or longer to, recognize our place here as the sovereign First Nations people and to get our land back and to have our sovereignty, then so be it. We'll keep fighting for that long. We're a culture that's been here for 80,000 years. 250 years is absolutely nothing to us. It's a drop in the ocean. But at the end of the day, our liberation, it doesn't depend on the approval of a colonial majority. It depends on our own strength, our own vision, and our refusal to disappear.
Absolutely. 80,000-year-old culture and the clarity with which you speak and the clarity of so many sovereigns and First Nations people on this continent really shows the extent to which that, I guess, truth and reality and staunchness and power was embedded within the culture. And as you absolutely say, yes, 250 years is just but a drop in the ocean. And I really of the time that First Nations people have been on this continent and in this world, and I think we'll get back to a more just world if we fight for it. It really is, I think, telling and depressing that there was more of a movement in the, really in the 70s, and clearly there was a fight back to get us to where we are today, which challenges the notion that things get better over time and that the arc of, human, humanity arcs towards progress. I think that's absolutely not the case. And having that, truth and having that fight and resistance is something that we need to do every day and, do it materially in everything that we do on a daily basis and to join the struggle. Kieran, I want to thank you so much for your time and insights. But not only that, I also want to thank you for the deep work which you do to unravel. There's a lot to unravel, a lot of mistruths, lies, and false narratives. Unpack, explain, and teach in a way that's digestible and understandable. There's a lot of work that goes into that, and I really have to say that, yeah, we see it, and I'm really grateful. Is there anything else you'd like to add to this discussion?
I'll try and be quick. I suppose, one thing just to really draw in that point you just made about how things don't always actually get better with time and things don't progress over time. Monday of this week was Sorry Day, where the government apologized for the stolen generations. Now, to give a bit of a evidence, I suppose, or something for people to look at when we talk about how things don't get better over time. Today, our children are removed at higher rates by this colony and put into out of home care and foster care and adopted out to non-Indigenous families at higher rates than during the official stolen generation policies of the early and mid 1900s. So, Kevin Rudd come out and apologized back in 2007, nearly 20 years ago now, apologized for this horrific theft of children over decades during these stolen generation policies. But today, they're taking our children at even higher rates than what they apologize for. So, it really just shows that things don't actually always get better over time. And in fact, quite a lot of the time, things get worse as time progresses. The only other thing I would add as well is just an encouragement for listeners to be discerning. Now, at the end of the day, this colony has never done anything progressive for us. Every single act of legislation that this colony has passed in regards to our people have impacted us detrimentally. Most of those acts and legislation still perpetuate the genocide of my people and our ongoing and illegal occupation by this colonial entity. Just for people to follow the paper trail, the evidence, for example, of the Voice to Parliament's connection to Zionists, to mining lobbies, and to racist politicians was very much on the public record at the time. People could literally go and Google it and read it for themselves. And in fact, quite a lot of this information was ironically on the very own websites of, the government, of the Yes campaign, of these, mining groups that were donating to the Yes campaign. I just would ask people to, stop being so gullible and stop being conned and realize that this colony never has and never will have our best interests at heart.
Thank you so much, Kieran. What powerful words to end on, and what a call to all of us to be discerning. I think I would hope that the last 2 years of really seeing what genocide and ethnic cleansing and occupation looks like in real time, I think that's been galvanizing. And I just want to thank you so much for your time today. And we will catch up very soon.
No worries. Thanks. Have a good one.
We've just been listening to a conversation with Kieran Stewart-Asherton, a founding member of the BPU, Traditional Owner and Sovereign Black Man from Wandiwandian Country, speaking about the aftermath of the Voice referendum, and also actually the prologue to the Voice referendum. So very illuminating, and I guess maybe educative, eye-opening episode out there that hopefully was as illuminating to you listeners as it was to us here in studio. If you want to learn more about that particular topic, please listen to Yilamin episode from 21st May, which is last week. Yilamin is going to be on again today on Wednesday at midday, and is just a really excellent must listen to program at 3CR.